Welcome to Stupid Not Stupid. I'm Matt, here as always with my man Jason, the co-host whose meat is just too tough to eat.
Wow, that almost sounds really awful, man.
almost. Jason, how you doing, my man?
I'm doing well. This is, I think this is 4 and 4 weeks, right?
I think we're like hovering. If we get it out, we could make like 4 and 5 weeks, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, we're right on the edge. Well, I'm going to break precedent, Jason, because this is a Their Stupid Edition. So we do have a guest this week that I'm excited about. And I know usually on Their Stupid Edition, we don't do We're Stupid Edition.
That's right. Yeah. It's bad form. We just look like idiots. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I have a hellworthy trespass. So it's time for
Matt and Jason are stupid.
You suck.
All right. So there's a couple things. One, I realized we're not doing a very good job on We're Stupid because we haven't always been recapping what the topic was of the episode previously. We've just been throwing out like random facts and then correcting them with absolutely no context. So I'll say our last episode, which is doing really well, is Ants Rule the World is the title. And in that episode, we make the case that ants are the dominant species on Earth, or I made the case.
Well, one of us made the case. Yeah.
Yeah. And as you know, in that episode, I mentioned one of my favorite authors, Robert Rapino, and we tagged his series in the post when we put it up, and he DM'd me and was like, he was like, great episode, man, this is so cool, thanks for the shout out. And then he retweeted us to like all his followers, and like it took off. It was pretty cool. But then after he finished the episode, he messaged me and he's like, hey man, I really enjoyed the podcast, but the main character in my novel, his name is Mort, not Morty, the E is silent. And I was just like, man, I was so crestfallen. I was like at the highest high. I was like, Robert Rapino just personally messaged me to say he liked our podcast. And then he had to correct me for mispronouncing the protagonist's name in the entire series. So my worst stupid mea culpa is my deep apologies to Robert Rapino. It is Mort, not Morty. And everyone should go out and read the War with No Name series, which is fantastic.
That just really makes you look stupid, man.
Yeah. Well, that's why we call it We're Stupid Edition. Anyway. Okay. Well, with my pendants behind us, I'd like to welcome our guest for this week, the world famous Rag Reynolds. And I have to use that term loosely because there are parts of the world Rag does not personally ascribe legitimacy to. So we've got to be careful when we call him world famous, but he is a friend of the show. He's making his second appearance. His YouTube channel is always a hotbed of internet controversy, and you can get his book, Medium Rare, A Guide to Fine Dining and Perfect Timing on Amazon, and his new brilliant indie film, Behooved, catalogs the trials and tribulations of a man who has his hands surgically removed and placed with horse hooves. So that should give you all the context you need. And welcome back, Rags.
I mean, you see international sensation, and I prefer Scottish mastermind, but whatever.
Well, hasn't some of the pushback to your Australia videos been that Scotland doesn't exist? Is that...
The big thing that always gets me is people are like, oh, how would you feel if I said your country wasn't real? You're saying Australia's not real. You're saying this isn't real. How would you feel if I said Scotland's not real? And I'm like, I wouldn't care because I'm not a little bitch. That's my reaction every single time. Like, why do you care what some random person in the other side of the world on the internet that you've never even heard of before says about your country? Like, if I say America's not real, like, what are you going to do? You'll go, huh, that's okay, that's stupid. And you'll move on with your day. Like, but there are some people who think that it's, for some reason, they'll go onto YouTube and they'll hate watch like 15 hours of content, leaving a comment and everything. And I'm like, okay, I guess you're just a kid on your in your bed, like your little race car bed on your mom's iPad or something. I don't know. But anyway.
All right. Well, we believed that Scotland exists, so we got your back, Rags.
Thank you.
I also wanted to say, because I think since we last had you on the show, I think you got married. Is that right?
Yeah, I did.
How did that go? How is it going?
Just the same as before, honestly. It's just it is what it is. I mean, I'm quite a laid back guy. I mean, I go through my life is kind of very level, I would say. Like I'm constantly there's ups and downs, but I kind of stay at this little plateau, and big events kind of I ease into them and then I ease out with them, and yeah, I'm always the same.
Well, I hope that this show tonight will be a peak for you. At least we'll break the plateau for you, Rex.
At least a peak of my day. Although I did have some really good chicken earlier, so closely contested.
All right. Well, speaking of food and drink, fine dining and perfect timing, Jason, what do you got on tap this evening?
Absolutely nothing original whatsoever. I'm once again two-fisting, drinking a Raging Bitch, and I've got a glass of the Woodford Reserve.
Okay, well, I'm doing something in honor of our guest. I got the only scotch we had left in the bar, so the Glenfiddich 15-year special reserve, and I don't really like it, but because it's the most expensive thing that I have in the bar, I drink it on special occasions.
Glenfiddich is great.
It's not Glenfiddich I have a problem with. I think it's just scotch in general. I like bourbon.
That's why I'm actually drinking bourbon. I'm drinking Southern Comfort right now, but it's not my favorite. But is it even really bourbon? I mean, does it really count?
It's like high school bourbon. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what like Europeans think U.S. bourbon
is. I didn't buy it. My wife bought a bottle, so I went and stole some because I'm all out. I mean, I was out earlier. I was out at a restaurant and a wine bar, and I drank a lot of wine today, but now I'm drinking this.
Didn't we ask you last time what we had to drink and you're like a couple bottles of wine? That's what we started
with. For some reason, I always end up recording these things. It's always after I've been drinking. I mean, I've kind of sobered up by now and like, I'm just, okay, now I'm drinking again. But yeah, I'm okay. That's just how it goes.
That's all right.
It's just when you record things this late, and for me anyway, it ends up, that's like saying I just drink every day. I don't drink every day. So, okay. I'm going to stop talking now. I'm digging a hole deeper, aren't I?
I'm going to stop talking and start drinking. That's what he's doing. Yeah. All right. Well, now that we've got all the housekeeping out of the way, it's time to get to this week's seminal question.
Right. Exactly. We finished with the drinks. Now let's move to the food. Right.
Yeah. So the question this week, Rags, and this comes out of a couple things. It builds off a couple previous episodes that Jason and I recently did, and something we were arguing over, and then a video that you put out recently. So the question is, stupid or not stupid, there's a practical case to be made for cannibalism, whether it be in terms of a survival situation or as a practical policy for humanity or our civilization. So that's what we're going to try to definitively answer in the next 45 minutes. Do you have an initial reaction or thought? I know this is something you've been thinking about a lot.
Do you want to give us an appetizer in the cannibalism? I'm going to say not stupid, and I'll leave it at that for now.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. Jason, do you have a predisposition on this one?
So I generally actually think that this one is not stupid at all, and I actually really encourage cannibalism. But in this particular case, for this episode, I'll take the position that it's stupid. Just play devil's advocate.
Yeah, I feel like we'd have to end it here if you agreed. So I appreciate that. So you know, this is what's interesting about cannibalism. If you take a step back and think about it, cannibalism falls into a category that not a lot of things fall into. Things that generally people consider to be wrong, no matter what. So even in the most dire circumstances, the most desperate situations, it's one of those things that even in a life or death scenario, it seems to be taboo. It's a question that seems like when I told people we were going to be doing this episode, they're like, that's ridiculous. What a stupid question. But it's something that actually gets considered at the highest levels of academia. For example, Harvard University. So as recently as this morning, I was able to sit in. Do you know Harvard posts like all of its lectures online? Yeah. On YouTube, which is kind of nuts. What is the Goodwill Hunting line where he's like, you just dropped 120 grand on a education I got with a $4 library card?
Why are people paying for that?
Yeah. So there's this professor at Harvard University who does a lecture every year, and it's one of the most famous lectures on campus. And it's essentially on the concept of utilitarianism. So the moral theory of utilitarianism. And he uses a case of in British maritime law to make the case as like the antidote for this. This is why it's perfect that Rags is here as a citizen of the UK. So I think what I'd like to do is we'll do a quick recap of this instance that seems to be the divergent, really critical point in society's viewpoint of cannibalism, whether it's stupid, not stupid, taboo or not taboo, which I think is I don't think that's the podcast we want to create as the sequel to this taboo, not taboo.
No. That we get dark fast, I think.
Yeah. So we'll dig through that case and then we'll try to answer the question. I do want to add a disclaimer at the beginning of this in case, like, I don't know, one of us ever runs for office or saves the world or does anything like that. I'm not personally advocating, even as I am going to come down on the side of not stupid. I'm not personally advocating that you should go out and murder anyone and eat them for the fun of it. This is a...
Well, I am. Yeah.
Well... I think that might be more in line with Scottish politics, though. That's going to help you out of the primary.
You might have a point.
Yeah. So we're making a academic continuation at a higher level, arguably, of a debate that began at Harvard, you know, and we'll just leave it at that.
Sure, because we're Harvard quality scholars.
Yes, we are. All right.
Beyond that.
So our story begins in 1883. And it begins, I'll just give you the opening headline in the first newspaper article back in 1883 that told the story of the sad tale that we're about to recount. A sadder story of survival at sea was never told than that of the survivors of the yacht Minette. Okay, I'm going to spell this, Jason. You tell me how to say it. Actually, Rags, you might be able to tell us because I'm pretty sure it's a British ship. Mignonette. Minuet.
Hey, it looks more French to me than anything else. I don't know. It's like Mignonette. I don't know.
Yeah,
why are you asking me?
It's closer to Minoe. Yeah.
Can we call it the Minnow? Yeah. For the purposes of the story, it's the Minnow.
Yeah, it makes me think of French. That's what it looks like to me.
It's the SS Minnow. Okay, so the SS Minnow, not as the same namesake as the most famous SS Minnow of Gilligan's Island, but the SS Minnow foundered in the South Atlantic in 1883, 1,300 miles from shore. So these guys are in trouble. The crew had four members on it. So the captain, Captain Dudley, the first mate, Stevens, Brooks, the sailor. I'm not sure what the captain and the first mate did, if there was one guy who was totally responsible for the sailing. And then the fourth crew member was the cabin boy, Richard Parker, who was a 17-year-old orphan on his first sea voyage ever. Are you already seeing where this is going, Jason, who the short man out is going to be?
Say, I know who gets the short straw on this one. Yes.
Yeah. the newspaper goes on to make the point in their opening recounting of the fate of the SS Minnow. They were all men, quote unquote, of excellent character. So right. Just keep that in mind as we begin. They're starting from a moral high ground. So we can't prejudge. We're not going to just assume these are bad guys in a bad situation.
These are the best savages or thugs. Right. Yeah.
No, this was the best humanity had to offer. And if they can succumb to the temptation, I think we really all need to look inwardly before we judge them. So in the course of their travels off the coast of the Horn, a wave hits the ship and the Minnow goes down. All four men escape to a lifeboat. All they're able to grab.
The Minnow would be lost.
The Minnow would be lost. Rags, is that something in Scotland? Do you know what we're talking about?
No. I mean, maybe I'm just oblivious to what's going on, but I don't know.
Yeah, there's a TV show in the United States called Gilligan's Island that has a very famous theme song that I sing to Matt often to get it stuck in his head like an earworm.
Like he'll be walking out the door and he'll be like, hey, Matt, and he'll be like, and the Minnow would be lost. The Minnow would be lost. And then they'll be stuck in my head for the next week. So look, a wave hits the ship. Everyone gets on a lifeboat. All they can grab is two cans of preserved turnips. No water. That's all they got. So they last it out.
That's a real crap thing to grab.
Yeah.
Out of everything you could have, like, a can of pineapple, a can of like tuna, anything but turnip.
Exactly. Yeah, at a certain point, you just use those as bait to try and catch fish, right? Like,
So the crew makes it the first 3 days eating nothing, drinking nothing. They hold out, preserving their precious turnip reserve on the Rags, we're going to lose you there. You never thought you'd hear the phrase turnip reserve?
I think I'd just throw it. I think I'm like, I don't want to eat it. I'll just die. Bye. It's not worth it.
That's right. On the fourth day, they open one of the cans. They have a turnip feast. On the fifth day, they catch a turtle. They dress it up with the remaining turnips and have a snack for a couple more days.
Turnip casserole.
But once they consumed all the turnips and turtle, they went 8 more days. No food, no water. At the end of this 8-day period, the cabin boy, he did the one thing you're not supposed to do in a life raft. Well, I guess there's more. We'll save this for taboo, not taboo, the things you're not supposed to do in a life raft. But he drank seawater. So I don't think we need Jason to check in his scientific credentials to tell us what happens when you drink seawater. It's not a good thing. So he drinks seawater. He drinks a lot of it and goes into a coma. On the 18th day, so I think they've gone 10 days now with no food and water. The captain comes up with the idea that they're going to draw straws. We'll draw straws. Whoever gets the short straw, that's who we murder. That's who we eat. That's how we're going to sustain ourselves. Booker, the sailor, refuses. He says he won't do it. This is an important point for later on. Booker says, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to draw straws. They make it 2 more days. And the captain says to Booker, look away. And he goes up to the cabin boy, who at this point is comatose, just like laying in a huddled ball in the bottom of the raft. And he whispers into his ear, your time has come, and then stabs him in the neck, stabs him in the neck, collects all
this
the blood.
Real.
This is 100% real. And the beautiful, but you know what the best thing about this is? None of this is refuted. Like, this is from their own accounting.
Yeah, but who says your time has come and then stab someone? That's like some crazy horror movie shit. Like, no one says that. Yeah, you just like, kill them. Yeah, you don't say that. You just go die.
Everyone who recounts it, including the captain who stabbed him in the neck himself, tell the exact same story. That's what's one
he
of the
just wants to sound like a
kid.
Badass. Of yeah, course exactly. He's going to say that.
That's what Tarantino would do. That's not what.
That's not what people do.
I want to believe that's what he said. So you guys can live in a different world if you want to. I want to live in a world where that's the badass phrase that he uttered before.
We're going to call that stupid then.
Jason's in on that one.
Yeah, I think I'm on Rag's side with this okay. one.
So Brooks didn't participate in the murder and refused to draw straws, but Brooks didn't turn down the smorgasbord that was prepared before him.
Wow, taking no risk and all the reward. Gotcha.
Exactly, exactly. So they subsist on the corpse of the cabin boy for the next 3 days until they were rescued. And I'll just throw this one out because I think it's pretty incredible. Brooks kept a diary of the entire event. This is his entry from the day that they are rescued. On the 24th day, as we are having our breakfast, a ship appeared at last.
Can you just right? Can we just like picture this? Like, imagine right here. Here's me. I'm Brooks, okay, and I'm sitting on this boat, this little lifeboat type thing, and like I'm sitting here, and I've got my two mates here, like
having a man sandwich,
and I'm writing this down, like. What? These people have eaten in 8 days and you've still, for some reason, you're writing down on a journal. Like, I would have probably eaten the journal by now. Like, before I'm, like, how do they still have things? Like, okay, I grab, no wonder they got turnip because they were too busy grabbing a bloody journal. Like, why?
Well, and then you see the ship approaching, and instead of trying to, like, hide the evidence of the cannibalism, they just record it in the journal. Like,
right.
Let me throw the body overboard. Yeah. See ya. Yeah. Bye.
So after the three men are rescued, they're returned to England and they are put on trial for murder. The captain and the first mate, Dudley and Stevens, of the namesake of the case here, the Crown versus Dudley and Stevens, are actually the ones charged. And Brooks turns state's evidence. So the guy who refused to draw straws but still partook of the unholy feast becomes a witness against them in the case. And
I thought you said that all four of these people were upstanding citizens. That is not upstanding.
Well,
hey, I think they are.
And it's all comparative based on the standards of the day. We can't judge history by our modern standards.
And
Jason.
A snitch is a snitch. It doesn't matter what era you lived in.
So the thing that's interesting about this, and the reason that this particular case is one that's taught in law schools across the world, and this famous lecture happens at Harvard every year, is because, you know, this isn't actually the first case of cannibalism or murder on the high seas that led to cannibalism that was brought before the courts in Great Britain. It's the one where the judges got tired of the jury acquitting the people of cannibalism.
Wow.
So this is where we have the question of the moral dilemma of the moral and legal dilemma of cannibalism in extreme circumstances, which I think is going to be the primer here for the stupid, not stupid question we have to answer.
All right.
All of the defendants in the case were cruising to being found not guilty by the jury. It was almost a foregone conclusion. And the judge in the case, who was tired of these cases getting off, pulled a tricky legal maneuver. And he basically told the jury they could only report back to the court the facts of the case as they saw them. And then they would have to return a special verdict, which is the judge would read a verdict to them sentence by sentence, and then the jury would affirm that that sentence was correct. And then based off of the jury's affirmation of the judge's special verdict, he would render a guilty or not guilty verdict to be confirmed later by a panel of other judges.
See, I find that far more morally vacuous than killing somebody and eating them on the high seas.
Yeah.
But, so you're already coming over to my side.
Give me all the humans. I'll eat them all.
So they go through this process. All the men are found guilty. They're all sentenced to death eventually by the full panel of judges. But public opinion really starts to turn against the Crown and the justice system in London because of this verdict. And people are making the case that, you know, in instances of extreme peril where you have to kill one to preserve the life of others, or looking at it from the standpoint of this guy was already in a coma, he was already going to die. So is what they did really murder, based off of those moral dilemmas that really stirred up the mob in London, the Crown commuted the sentence from death to 6 months in prison, which I think is about...
Which in 1883 in London was death.
So bringing this back full circle to our Harvard lecture and the question of utilitarianism, when we look at the theory of utilitarianism, what we're really looking at in terms of a moral question is, how do we do the most good for the most people? How do you prevent the most pain while doing the most good? So this is the kind of legal precedent setting case law scholars and theorists look back on and say, if we're taking a utilitarian approach here to morals, which is what the kind of principal litmus test that law students are told to apply to questions of legal or moral gray areas, did they prevent the most harm and do the most good? And I think you could argue that they did, and you could apply that same standard to similar instances of cannibalism in extreme situations.
So I think the key there, though, is extreme situations, right?
Right.
Because from, again...
That's the first question. We'll get to the practical application of cannibalism in a minute. No. This is just extreme situations.
But talking from a moral standpoint here, if I'm supposed to be taking the stupid side of this argument, there is a sort of a slippery slope argument here, right? Like if you're dealing with a large population of people in a drought and there isn't enough food, you know, you're dealing with a famine, at what point do you sort of use this same argument to say this is an extreme situation? Why don't we,
right,
you know, feed a third of the population to the other two thirds of the population? Because
sure,
that's what's in the best interest of two thirds of the population.
That's just a bigger lifeboat, as far as I'm concerned. Right. No, I don't think that's a slippery slope at all. I think it's the exact same situation. Rags?
I feel like it's maybe a little bit different because, like, if you're in, say you're in some little small town and everyone's starving in the town. Okay, I feel like that's different from like stranded in the middle of the ocean. You're in the middle of the ocean, you have nothing around you. It's just you and maybe the people around you. You have absolutely, you can't even go anywhere. You are stuck on that boat. Like, at least if you're in some little town, you can like take a chance and like go walking for a week. And maybe you come up on something, maybe you've got a chance to appear somewhere else. But I think when you're in that little boat, you can't even do that. I mean, you jump in the water, you're just going to die because it's freezing. I mean, so you're stuck on that boat. But what's your choice? Eat the boat,
right?
Eat the person.
Eat your journal.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question for me, I think personally, comes down to it's the question of murder. Obviously, you're killing someone, and in any of these cases, it's killing it. I don't have an issue with the fact that someone's eating them, and maybe we'll get to this later, but I don't even think there's an issue like if. Not in extreme circumstances, I don't see the moral issue with eating another person. Mm-hmm. The issue is more actually with killing the person before you eat them, I would say. But yeah, I would say there's a difference between the boat situation versus the town.
No, and that's an interesting point too. So the 17-year-old kid who is murdered had basically already killed himself, right? If you're drinking that much seawater, like the saline is going to do you in eventually. If he was already in a coma, like this kid wasn't going to survive another 24 hours, 48 hours. So he's kind of dead already. Do you wait until he dies and risk the fact that you might also die in that while waiting for the inevitable? Or do you just help him along? As opposed to the hypothetical that we had a second ago, where you've got a village of people who are starving. Well, if you draw straws between a population of 100 and 33 of them draw the short straw, I got to tell you, if it doesn't matter how hungry I am, I'm picking up a machete to make sure that I'm not getting murdered.
Yeah.
So stupid or not stupid, Jason, you think that it was morally justified, the actions of the captain and the first mate, to kill and consume the boy who was going to die anyway to preserve their own lives?
So I want to say that it was morally justified, but I'm actually wrapped around the axle about this thing, the comment of... You know, your time has come before he stabs him in the neck.
Like, so if you would have just left the Quentin Tarantino moment out, you'd be fine with it.
Like I don't.
It's like taking pleasure in it.
That's right. Yeah. It's like, and leaving that for posterity. Like, see what a man I was about. Like, you're doing this thing out of necessity, not because you're a badass, right?
He's gloating about it in his journal. He's like, he's actually documenting how much of a badass he is. Like, if that was me, I'd be like, I wouldn't be writing anything. I'd be burning that journal. I'd be eating him and throwing the evidence away and being like, there was never another guy.
That's right.
Yeah. I would just he drowned on the boat. Another, yeah, the wave took him overboard.
At sea, Yeah, yeah. I would be saying we're at sea 3 days less than whatever it was or whatever. Like, I'd be making shit up. I wouldn't be admitting to that.
Right. And to Rag's point earlier about, you know, this village hypothetical that we were talking about, there is a similar circumstance. You guys are familiar with the book Alive that came out mm-hmm. back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. So this was the group of soccer players. I can't remember. They were from, I think, somewhere.
Argentina?
Yeah. It's been years since I've read the book. But yeah, it was South or Central America. They were flying over the, I don't even remember what mountain range it was.
Andes.
It was the Andes. And the plane wrecks, and there are a number of survivors, but there are also a lot of people who are killed in the wreck, and they start to eat the dead, and eventually a small group of them manages to hike out of the mountains, but it takes them weeks, and they're, you know, they suffer from massive frostbite and everything else trying to get out of the mountains. But like, a huge number of these people actually survive because of cannibalism. So to Rag's point, they were able to survive by walking out of there, but they wouldn't have been able to survive had they not eaten human flesh.
Yeah.
But again, to Rag's point, they also, my recollection is they didn't kill anybody.
No, they ate the dead bodies.
Right.
Thus, again, we're checking a box here. The case for cannibalism, stupid or not stupid. So we have just found a justifiable instance for cannibalism that we don't think is morally or legally unjustified.
So morally, yes, I agree. Legally is more problematic, right? Like, it's mm-hmm. illegal to eat people, even in yeah. extreme circumstances.
Is that stupid?
There's no dispute against that. If something's illegal, it's illegal. There's right. no real argument there. So
right.
And morals is a gray area, because you could argue morality is subjective to the individual person. It's about your own values.
Well, there's a whole other episode. But Rags brings up an interesting point on the subjectivity of this. So, like I said, we have cannibalism in this weird category in our society where it's the thing that's unforgivable, the thing that cannot be spoken of. Kind of like with Amelia and Frank or Fred. Go back and hear our Amelia Earhart episode to learn about how Amelia Earhart cannibalized her navigator on a desert island in the South Pacific.
Whatever his name may have been.
Whatever his name may have been. Yeah. He was a tasty snack. But cannibalism, traditionally, you know, pre this case, and especially, you know, 100 years before this case, actually wasn't that frowned upon. So across Europe, what was it called? Mummia. I looked this up. They used to actually excavate bodies and grind up the mummified remains into a powder and use it to treat all kinds of different ailments and societies.
Yeah, but that was like an aphrodisiac and a boner pill. Like that was a very different.
It was the Viagra of the yeah, of medieval yeah, Europe. Yeah. But a lot of the civilizations that that Europeans made contact with during the Age of Exploration practiced ritualized cannibalism. My favorite cannibalism story from that is Daniel Battelli's podcast, History on Fire. He talks about how Cortez has the Aztecs surrounded, and they're all starving to death, and all they have is potatoes left inside their city. And they throw the potatoes out while they're starving at the at the Spanish and say, "We don't need them. We'll have lost a feast on soon when you guys get up here," which is like, I feel like the ultimate badass expression.
But that is way more badass than the "your time has come."
Yes. Your time has come.
It's far more badass, but I suspect that they were mistaken. They thought those potatoes were turnips, right?
But the catch here in all of this is the term cannibalism. Do you know where it comes from, Jason? Columbus coined the term cannibalism. And the rationale here is Columbus comes back to the Queen of Spain and says, you know, I've discovered all these people. They're over here in the Americas. A lot of them are peaceful. They want to help us out. But there's a small group of them that eat the flesh of their enemies. They're called the cannibal. And he said that was the name of their tribe. And then Columbus returns to the New World, realizes that the friendly, peaceful Native Americans that he enslaved to mine gold for him in the Indies didn't produce any gold. Queen had given him license to capture and enslave anyone who ate the flesh of another human. So Columbus just said, "You're all cannibals. You all eat the flesh of other humans." And we ascribed this nomenclature, cannibal, to the other, to things that were not like us, that were the, you know, they're the bad guys, they're the heathens, they're the barbarians. And I think that that is ingrained in part of this, why it's so easy for us to make it taboo, when really it used to be widely accepted.
That's very on brand for Christopher Columbus, I guess. My favorite part of that whole story, like, everybody talks about this idea that, you know, he came to the New World and he claimed it for Spain, and even though it was populated by indigenous people, what people tend to forget about that story is he did come to the New World and declare it for Spain, but he thought he was in India. He thought it was already a sovereign country and still declared it for Spain.
Hey, this is what I've been arguing about Australia. People go there, but it's actually New Zealand.
Yeah, this is where we need Eddie Izzard in here.
Built up empires. We stole countries. That's what you do. That's how you build an empire. We stole countries with the cunning use of flags. Yeah. You just sail around the world and stick a flag in. I claim India for Britain. And they go, you can't claim us, we live here. 500 million of us. Do you have a flag? We don't need a bloody flag, it's our country, you bastard. No flag, no country, you can't have one. That's the rules that I've just made up.
All right. So before we go to the second question of just the practicality of cannibalism as a widespread societal practice, which I think is much more interesting to this largely settled legal argument. Rags, do you have anything else on just the morality of cannibalism in extreme situations?
No. I mean, for morality wise, like cannibalism, I don't see like say there's a dead person. And I'm hungry. I don't see what's morally wrong about eating a person. Like, if it's my choice, okay, I can live or I can die. And it all hinges on whether I eat this person or not. I think it's a pretty straightforward choice to make. I mean, okay, I'm going to eat the person. And it's because survival comes first. And it's like, the question of self-defense, it's a very similar thing. It's like, well, someone's coming up to you with a gun. They're going to shoot you in the head. What, are you going to just stand there and let them shoot you? Or are you going to fight back? And I think it's the same with like cannibalism, and it's self-preservation. And when it comes to any sort of extreme circumstance, I think people are justified in preserving their own life. It becomes different, obviously, if you have other options. Like, for example, there's two of you standing there. Okay, maybe you have to kill someone. Okay, maybe you can actually run off and try and find some other means of hunting or whatever. But when you're like in that extreme circumstance on a boat, for example, I think it's more than justified. And I don't think there's anything necessarily that's morally wrong about that.
You get into those gray areas, though, like where, you know, you're starving and it's you and one other person who's probably sick or wounded and there's a can of turnips. Man, you might have to go for the person, right? Like-
You know, speaking of vegetables in cannibalism situations, have you seen, there's actually a Monty Python skit that makes fun of this exact incident because it is famous in the UK. So they go through the whole exercise of deciding who they're going to kill on the boat and they kill them. And then they call the waiter over, be like, okay, so I'll have like a side of broccoli and like and order the rest of their meal. So, all right, Jason. So would you agree then if not stupid in emergency situations, should at least not be categorized in this weird sort of taboo area for really no discernible reason?
See, I actually see it the exact opposite way. I think that it should be a taboo because I think that having it as a taboo actually disincentivizes it in civilized terms. But I think that it should be absolutely acceptable in extreme circumstance.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, this has been a meaty argument. So a lot of meat on the bone with this one.
A lot to chew on. Yeah.
A lot to chew on. Yeah. So let's move
food
to the second.
Food for thought, as it were. Right?
So this week's second question, as usual, like I said, stems out of a previous episode. And in our Ants Rule the World episode, we established that ants are definitively the dominant species on Earth, and they are coming for us. I think even Jason was agreeing with me by the end. Yeah. And as Sun Tzu taught us, we need to get in the mind of our enemies, in this case, specifically the hive mind of our enemies. So if we're going to defeat the ants, we have to adopt the ants' most prodigious quality, and that's their utilitarianism. They are the ultimate utility creatures. So we have to maximize our own utility. And that's what maximizing your resources is all about. And when it comes to dead bodies, Jason, I got to tell you, we are wasting a ton of resources. And we have to find a practical way to put those resources to work.
Not just resources, but also real estate, right?
Right, exactly. Okay, so let's start just with cemeteries then. I don't know what's the cemetery situation in Scotland, Rags? You guys have been around a little bit longer than us. Do you guys still do cemeteries?
Yeah, I mean, I've had like distant family members die in like the last 5 years and they've been in cemeteries.
How did they taste?
I have no idea. I mean, maybe they were maybe a bit old for my liking. If I'm going to eat someone, I'd rather a bit younger and healthier. But, you know what I never get, right? I mean, this is a bit sidetracking, but I never understand, like, people talk about, oh, we're on a desert island and you don't want to be the fat guy because everyone's going to eat you. I'm like, why would you want to eat the fat guy? He's covered in fat. What you want to eat is the lean guy, because he's going to be more tender and taste good. You want to eat the big, muscly, lean guy. It's like, I don't care I'm fat. Like, you don't want to eat me. I'm just going to be lots of fat. No one enjoys fat. What we're going to do is we're going to go after you, because you're the fit guy. You're lean. You're going to taste way better. You eat healthier.
I think you eat the least persuasive guys who you end up eating.
Yeah. Lowest, weakest guy, right?
Yeah. All right. So look, Jason brought up cemeteries. So cemeteries is a great argument for why we need to start utilizing our corpses, our society's
by utilizing,
corpses in a different
you mean
way.
Using.
Yeah. I'm not going down this road with you again, Jason. When you think about the burial process, so there's obviously the embalming portion of that. The chemicals we use for embalming that we're pumping into bodies and putting in the ground, it's terrible, terrible for the environment. So that's an easy one right there. We don't need to be putting unnecessary chemicals into the ground. Low-hanging fruit, easy argument against
cemeteries.
We're going
right back to the Return of the Living Dead episode. Right, yeah.
So just in the U.S. alone, every year, we use 30 million feet of hardwood, so of boards, like 30 million feet of boards to build coffins. 2,700 tons of copper and bronze, and 104,000 tons of steel, and 1,600,000 pounds of reinforced concrete just to house dead bodies, which is the equivalent of about 4 million acres of forest and could build 4.5 million homes a year. And that's just the U.S., and we use that for housing dead bodies.
Can I just say, like, why don't we just bury dead bodies naked? Like, why do we need to build them a little coffin? They're dead. That would solve the problem.
Well, I got one answer to all of that. Jobs. That's a huge industry. A lot of people make a whole lot of money off of that industry. I don't know if you guys have ever dealt with somebody close to you having passed away where you've actually been in charge of the funeral or had to deal with the expenses. Holy crap. It costs a lot of money to die in this country.
Right. And so that's my point. Is this a great utilization of resources? I guess you're making the case that it's a cool jobs program, but we could put those.
That's why my loved ones are getting dumped in the pet cemetery and just left alone. Like, but I'm not related to them.
there's got to be a better way to put this biomass to work, Jason. And, you know, encasing them in stone or putting them in a pine box, it's not a great or efficient use of resources. And that's not even to mention that you have to maintain the cemetery. Cemeteries are meticulously maintained. So all of the labor, the water, everything that goes into maintaining the greenscape, it should be pumped into agriculture.
Or golf courses. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Like, literally, what's more wasteful, a cemetery or a golf course? I don't even know.
I would actually argue that a golf course is, but
I would agree.
Yeah. But, well, you guys have the Trump National Golf Course up there, so that's probably saving you a bunch of money, Rags.
I think we actually get a lot of money coming from that, probably. Yeah. Tourism and all whatever. But
have you visited Mr. Trump's estate up in your homeland?
No, I haven't. My grandparents have. They've stayed at Trump Turnberry. They said it was a nice hotel. I've never been.
Nice hotel. Doesn't pay a lot of taxes, but
right.
A nice,
yeah,
hotel.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So look, the cemetery argument, I think, is pretty clear. The way that we currently dispose of our bodies is not efficient, and it's not a great use of resources. Now, the obvious counter argument is, okay, cremation. So I looked into this too.
Right.
Cremation is also terrible for the environment. Do you know all the shit that's in your body that gets pumped into the atmosphere when we light you on fire? It's terrible. Like, I mean, maybe you guys more so than me, but humans are terribly unhealthy. There's all kinds of terrible things. Microplastics, heavy metals. We've built
up. You're about to argue that we should eat them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right.
And I don't know what you're talking about.
And hey, I'm on your side, so.
I eat nothing but turnips, man. Like,
yeah. So Rags is actually right. So there's not really a practical case for just eating human flesh.
I was going to say, if you're going down the cremation road and your argument is that it releases all of these toxins into the environment, well, we know how to deal with that. We have biomass power plants that have.
It's called rendering.
Right. Yeah. And we have ways of filtering out all of those heavy metals and all those toxins. This is a known process. So my argument was going to be, we spend a whole lot of money using natural gases to burn humans just to throw the ashes on the ground.
Right.
Why not throw them into some place where that heat is going into a steam turbine?
I have a better idea. Instead of burying people, instead of cremating them, why don't we just like throw them up to the North Pole or something and let them freeze?
just pile them up.
That's basically,
there's nothing up there.
Right. Well, that's what we've been doing on Mount Everest for.
Or there's polar bears. The polar bears can eat them.
That's a good point.
The problem is, Rags, the North Pole's not going to be there much longer, and then they'll all just wash back down here. So that's the biggest problem with that. But no, you guys
raised... the South Pole.
You guys,
I think that was actually a solution on our zombie episode, right?
Yeah, I think it was actually. Yeah, but no, you both raise an interesting point. So there actually isn't a practical case for just eating dead people. Like, we can't feed all the homeless people in America by just feeding dead people to the homeless. Like, that's not a practical a practical solution.
It sounds amusing though. A social experiment. I want to see that.
The poor, they have no bread. Well, let them eat dead people.
Yeah. Let's just take a country like Norway or something and just like throw all the dead people. Just like a social experiment. Like, would anyone really care if Norway went tits up? Like, who cares?
Well, I'm assuming
in Norway? Norwegians?
I was going to say, I'm assuming some Norwegians would care, but beyond that, yeah.
There's not that many of them. So human flesh, human meat doesn't have like a great caloric value. You don't get a ton of energy for it. So there's not like a high reward on the intake. Now, there is advantages. Yeah, it is. So
I thought it was like pork.
So it tastes like pork. Okay. It's not analogous to pork. Well, I hear secondhand it tastes like pork.
Yeah. How do you know this? Yeah,
it's not analogous to pork. But the other problems are there are pretty terrible side effects to humans for directly consuming human flesh. When we eat other animals, the parasites and the things that live inside of them aren't adapted to live in humans, so they don't affect us. If, you know, we eat humans, the parasites inside of humans are adapted to living in humans, and you'll overload your body with toxins and parasites.
Well, don't eat humans with parasites. I mean, that's pretty
strange. We all have them, though.
But don't you think if we ate humans long enough, would we not like evolve and adapt to then process
those of us who lived
would become like warlocks.
That could solve any overpopulation issues.
Okay, I think Rags might be on.
And that's why
here.
We also test on the homeless people or the Norwegians. Because who cares if those people go?
So I'm with you guys on this idea that we, unless we're going to do Rags' eugenics experiment.
I don't like that word.
I'm comfortable feeding flesh to homeless people, but that's where you draw the line.
Yeah. Use a different word to describe that, please.
Okay, so besides Rags' special experiment, I don't think there is a practical case, as much as I am on the side of making the case for cannibalism, for feeding dead people to other people. However, I think Jason hit on what the solution actually really is from a utilitarian point of view. And remember, when it comes to utilitarianism, we're trying to do the most good for the most people while minimizing the most harm. So we have this biomass resource. We can render it, like Jason talked about. So that's basically the process of breaking down things that are high in carbon into a fuel that can be burned and then put to use for a particular task. Or we can do what, you know, I'm from Washington State, what every hippie in Washington State does every day already, and I do here at my house where we're right now, Jason, you compost it. Why aren't we composting dead people and using them to grow food? Like right now we're basically like we're wringing out the ocean for fish to create fertilizer. When we have a great renewable source of fertilizer right here.
I'm just imagining like a family 20 years from now, like just living in the suburbs, and it's like the kids are out playing in the garden, they're growing their own potatoes, and the mother is like, hey Lucy, stop playing over there, your grandma's being disturbed, she's trying to grow his potatoes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what
leave her alone.
That's what oil
dogs
is
out there eating, digging up the crops. Right, yeah. leave my mother alone.
That's what we already do, Jason. That's what oil is. It's fossilized things. It's broken down carbon from things that used to be alive.
Yeah, but oil is fossilized things that used to be alive under massive amounts of pressure for hundreds of millions of years.
Right, but it still accomplishes the same thing. We could bury Rag's body out in my pepper garden behind the house, and it would
and
grow
great
peppers.
We may do that tonight.
We may do it anyway, yeah.
But the thing, to your point earlier, though, you know, the human body is, because of our diet, because of our lifestyle, is full of all of these toxic substances. So if you don't figure out something, like you can't just throw people into a compost heap and end up with healthy compost.
No, you have to render them like you do. We do this with animal parts all the time. It's called rendering.
It's simple, though. Right, but it's simple. All you do is you do a survey and you find the people who don't have these toxic diets, and then you abduct those people and murder them.
All the vegans, all the hippies, right?
Well, I heard Norway's a very healthy country.
People from all these, like, you know, how you like see all these tribes, like Amazonian tribes and all that, like people who are like almost living like 300 years in the past, yet they're living today. You go to those places and take those people. No one's going to notice.
Again, I know Rags shies away from the term eugenics, but I just got to say.
I don't think that's eugenics. That's just practical.
That has dietary implications. There's nothing about anybody's head size, right?
It's nutrition, not eugenics.
Yeah. I'm not discriminating. I mean, we can say grace. We can thank them for their sacrifice.
I don't know, Jason, though, from a scientific point of view, you're the closest we have on the show to a scientist. I mean, if we can render them, if we can compost them through some sort of filtration process, why are we spending money and expending resources to basically mummify biomass when we can put that biomass to work? And it's really the only thing stopping us from doing it, in my opinion, is a social construct based off of these antiquated ideas that, like, you know, going back to Columbus, going back to the court case we talked about, like, why aren't we utilizing this biomass? Like ants would. Why aren't we doing what the ants would do, Jason?
Well, we're not using this biomass primarily due to cultural issues, due to, as I said earlier, there's an entire like economy to this. There are religious implications, there are cultural implications, there are
religions and cultures that are proponents of cannibalism. That,
like, don't you think it's more just like ants are heartless bastards,
right?
And
right,
and like human beings are sentimental, whereas ants aren't. I mean, an ant dies. Do you think an ant sheds a tear for another ant?
But what is cannibalism? But
whereas human beings, they really care about their people who die, and that's why they don't eat them. That's why they don't want them used for other things, because they feel bad. They want to have a ceremony. They want to see their loved ones buried. And yeah, that comes probably from cultural sort of things in the past and traditions. And, oh, I want to see my mother buried, and I want to do this, and I want to do that. But ants don't, like, ants have never had that thing. So I guess it's just different sort of ideas. And as you keep saying, like, ants are very utilitarian. It's like they look almost at what the practical is. But ants, do ants have emotions? Like, that's really the question you're asking here. Do ants feel sadness? Do they feel happiness? Like, do they have that same emotional attachment as humans do?
But you're talking about sentiments, Rags, and what does cannibalism have to do with the sentimentality of it? It's just because the prevailing culture now has a problem with it. No. Lots of cultures, lots of religions have ritual cannibalism as part of their belief system.
No, but Rag is absolutely correct. Like, the reason it's taboo is because of emotion, because of sentimentality, mm-hmm. because of revulsion at this act that is so quote unquote uncivilized. And going back to a part of the discussion that we had earlier, the difference between morality and laws, right? The reason that we have laws is so that the individuals who have no morality in our society don't get to run roughshod over all of the rest of the people who
listen,
do.
Rags is our guest, Jason. Don't speak ill of him while he's here, like on the show with us. All right.
But again, you know, if I've got to be the one who's arguing against cannibalism here, which I actually don't really fully agree with, but it comes down to this exact point, right? The point of culture is to ensure, or the idea of culture in theory is to ensure the greatest amount of safety for people to survive as possible in the most egalitarian manner as possible. Well, I don't know that I totally agree with that. But this idea of you can't kill me to eat me, and we make that a legal definition, means that the serial killers of the world don't get to like just run roughshod, right?
I'm fine with you can't kill me to eat me, but I do think that there is a utility in doing something different with dead bodies. And let me put this scenario to you, Jason, because I think...
But would you really want to eat a dead body? Like, we don't even... Like, do you even really want... Like, okay, I'll eat a steak, but do you really want to eat a steak that's come from a dead cow? Like, well, obviously it's from a dead cow, but you don't want to wait... But you don't want the cow to die like naturally and then eat it is what I'm trying to say. Right. Like, you kill the cow when it's healthy so that you get a good bit of meat and you enjoy the meal. You don't want to take a human that's already like died of old age and it's going to be terrible, tough meat.
So,
like,
Rags, I'm not going to bring you a human steak. What I'm going to bring you is a plate of potatoes that was fertilized by the rendered biomass of a dead body. Would you have a problem with that?
Okay. No.
See? Not stupid. Now, let me put this to you, Jason. This, I think this is might be what brings you over. And this is, I think, what's going to prove that our entire taboo around this is a social construct. If
everything we do socially is a social construct. But yeah, go ahead.
Fuck off, Jason. Okay. If Donald Trump came out tomorrow with the fact that we should render and utilize for fuel
human bodies.
I'm going to do it just to piss you off from now. If Donald Trump came out tomorrow.
I'm
going to
correct you every fucking time.
If Donald Trump came out tomorrow and said that, 40% of Americans would say, fuck yeah, let's do it. We can buy the corpse potatoes at Walmart. It'll be great. It would become wallpaper. Like there would be politicians in the U.S. Congress today who would adopt it as a policy position and be in favor of it. That's how quickly we could flip the switch on this. Like, it's not taboo for some innate philosophical or something that's hard-coded in our DNA reason. It's like that because of a social construct. And that,
so what you're saying is we need to make like 10 email addresses each and start like spamming Donald Trump's emails.
Just put .gov at the end of all of them. One of them will get through.
Or .rus, right?
Yeah. Well, apparently there's that guy who's guessed his Twitter password twice and got it right. So we could just guess his Twitter password and tweet this out. But I'm saying, like, literally, if Donald Trump came out tomorrow
on Twitter, that won't work.
That's right. That's exactly right.
If Donald Trump,
you're living 2 years ago.
We'll put it on what's his new social media site? Quorum or something.
Remember.
Yeah, I don't know. But if Donald Trump came out tomorrow and said he was in favor of this, there would be legitimate elected leaders in the United States who'd be like, yeah, we should do it. And the stigma would begin to be chipped away at.
Yeah, but you pose that as though it's a solution and not a problem, right?
It's a solution to proving me right. Like, I don't care about the follow-on societal problems it creates as long as I get to, like, point to this episode and be like, remember that time I was right about that thing?
But just going down that particular social construct theory, we get right back to why I mentioned earlier that we have this incredible like burial ritual community within Western culture. Man, can you imagine the number of lobbies that would pop up immediately for all of the billions of dollars a year of people who provide coffins, provide, you know, burial services, provide funeral homes, like provide the chemicals that you pump into dead bodies to keep them from deteriorating for the 4 days where everybody comes and mourns. Like, the amount of money involved in that would immediately end that initiative, even if Donald Trump.
You would have a new industry. Because those people would now be in the industry of decomposing these bodies, breaking them down and using them for other means. So these people would transition.
They wouldn't
transition. It's an evolution of industry, baby.
I mean, okay, they might not want to. They'll be hesitant. So you almost need to force it. And there will be pushback.
You would have to force
it. But there will be jobs that still exist. If you go through with the push, I think that the same amount of money will exist, the same amount of industry will exist, et cetera.
I completely disagree with that. Because as Matt pointed out, like, most of that industry is very lavish and unnecessary. And what you're talking about is moving that into an industry of necessity. And you've got the same amount of biomass. You're just
What if you just did like ceremonial funerals? So like you still did what we do now, but you don't. But instead of actually burying them, or like people do cremations, but instead of actually cremating, it's just at the end.
We can still have the ritual.
The coffin gets taken off, and they do something else to it instead of putting it in the ground, instead of putting it in the furnace or whatever it is and burning it. You take it off and you do something else with that, and so you still have the whole industry. You still have the fact that there's people doing maybe presenting the body a bit better. You have people who are standing up there and giving a whole ceremony and all the rest of it. It's just maybe at the end of all that, the body goes somewhere different.
You do a little song and dance and then you launch it into space, right?
Yeah. This is like the adoption of any other kind of renewable energy, Jason. Like, I thought you were progressive. I'm surprised to hear your argument here. This is like solar or wave energy or geothermal. It's just another source of energy. And if we're going to lift people out of poverty, if we're going to abolish the third world, if we're going to have a brighter future for our children, then we need to start boiling dead.
Yeah. Why do you hear poor kids, Jason?
Yeah.
No, but man, you lived through the Clinton, or you were a kid in the Clinton years, but we've seen this story play out. When you try to change the way that an economic community pursues their living, the resistance that you find is really intransigent. There is no retraining these people to go from funeral homes to energy provision. Like, that's just not how it works. What you end up with is massive fights, massive inefficiency in the transition, And in this particular case, I think you would end up with dead bodies just piling up somewhere.
Well, I'll say this, Jason. The reason why I don't think your argument holds any biomass, when I imagine a funeral home director going in and doing his own lobbying, like they're all like Ben Stein. They're not going to be able to make an effective argument. I don't think they're going to be able to make their case
not
on the hill.
Not any one of them is going to go in alone. They're going to hire some really, really rich firm who knows what the hell they're doing. And
well, I'll already be in the pocket of the human biomass rendering industry. So they won't be able to hire the best lobbying firm in D.C.
So now I understand your subtext for this whole episode.
I'm just trying to launch a new industry, baby,
That's right.
I'm going to lead it.
This hits so many cultural touchstones with so many different communities. It's impossible for me to imagine that this would happen within a single generation. Like, I'm not opposed to the idea. Like, I think you're right. At some point, you run out of land for burying people. Like, the population of the world right now is larger than the population of the world in the past 100 years is more than the population of the world in the past, 1,000 years combined.
And we're still way behind the 250 quadrillion living ants. So just think about that, Jason.
I feel like it's way more likely, though. Like, you're definitely right about, like, eventually we run out of space to bury people and all the rest of it. But I feel like people are so averse to, like, cannibalism that we would be, it's far more likely that people start like having space burials and shit before they would ever adopt cannibalism. I really feel like
we're literally going to send resources off the planet as opposed to utilizing them on the planet.
I believe I'm in favor of all this cannibalism stuff, but I do think that the majority of people are so against it that I do think we would end up just wasting more resources by sticking to the sort of the sentimental aspect and, okay, well, now we're just going to do other types of funerals. We're going to send people to Mars to be buried. That's what's going to happen.
Can there literally be a worse ROI than launching dead bodies into space? Like, I can't think of one.
No, I think that pretty much encapsulates it. But at the same time, when we started canning tuna and turning it into chicken of the sea, like, I just don't envision some Soylent Green, scenario where all of a sudden we're canning some form of human meat or some form of vegetable that's grown using humans as fertilizer and calling it, like the tuna of the land, right? Like that's just not going to happen.
I just thought as well, like you could take celebrities and like there's going to be different brands. I mean, and the brands are going to be advertising using celebrities. It's going to be like, this is Tom Cruise potato brand. And it's going to be people eating Tom Cruise potatoes. And those are going to sell for like 5 times as much as like someone who's having like, I don't know, Bill Clinton potatoes or something. Like they're going to be like all these different things. And people are going to, like the women are going to be right up there with all these lonely, creepy men. I mean, they're going to be like, oh, I really want this Jennifer Aniston or whatever brand of tomatoes.
I think Rag is onto something here. If you could actually, like, if you knew who was fertilizing your food.
Yeah. Instead of just, like, generic random people, like, that's not going to work. People think that's disgusting. But as soon as you put, like, someone's favorite celebrity on that, they're like, oh, yeah, sign me up.
All right. I guess I'll start with you, Jason. So stupid or not stupid? Definitive answer here on the survival question and on the practicality question, there's a case for cannibalism.
On the survival question, it's really hard for me to argue that it's stupid. Like, I know that was the side that I took, but it's almost an impossible thing to argue unless you have some like religious aspect of it. Like, yeah, of course it's not stupid. From a, what was the second one?
For the practicality, like from a utilitarian standpoint, like the ants are attacking. We have a shortage of resources. We have to increase our productivity and efficiency. It's time to render bodies.
Yeah, from a utilitarian standpoint, like I understand the argument and I don't think that you're wrong. I just think that the application of it is almost impossible. So from there, I think it is kind of stupid.
This is the Electoral College all over again. You won't admit that I'm right because you think that it's too difficult to pull off. You don't believe in anything, Jason. That's your problem. All right. All right, Rags, from the survivability standpoint and then from a practicality standpoint, stupid or not stupid?
I agree entirely with Jason about the survivability. It's definitely, it's really hard to call it stupid.
Just with the preamble that you agree completely with Jason, you've lost all credibility, but continue.
Hey, only for survivability, right? Like, so...
I totally surviving. I agree with Jason. I agree with Jason. I agree. Yeah.
The surviving aspect, yeah, I mean, it's really hard to argue against it. As I said earlier, it's like if your choice is preserving your own life versus just dying, I mean, I think the choice is always to preserve your life, and so I think it's not stupid. But as far as practicality goes, I'm also inclined to lean not stupid, because I think it is practical. Like, I think you've detailed yourself a lot of different aspects, like breaking down bodies, using it as fertilizer, all the rest of it, and I think that is really practical. The issue becomes in terms of society and their morals and sort of their like intrinsic values and their sentimentality. And so I don't think that's really against the practicality, but it's more like against like this idea they have in their head. And so I could feel like with time, people could come around to it, like very, very slowly. Like 100 years ago, how many vegans were there 100 years ago?
Right. Zero.
And I mean, yeah. And whereas today, I mean, it's so common, like people, vegans, vegetarian. And I mean, I know that's different. I mean, it's not immoral to be a vegan in anyone's eyes, but I think it's a similar sort of thing where people are really like looking to adapt a little bit. But there's lots of things like that. I mean, take stupid things like, gay rights, women's rights. I mean, stuff like that. I mean, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, people were averse to those things. They think, oh, why do these people need this? These people are creeps. These people are whatever. And then suddenly, like, you're talking now, and I would say the vast majority of people accept people who are different. And I think that today, I don't think there's ever been a more accepting time to be alive. And I think that people are open to all sorts of new ideas, and maybe you just need to introduce them slowly. And so maybe in like 150 years from now, I feel like people could get on board. So yeah, definitely practically, maybe like if you've done it right now, I would say stupid. But if you do it slowly over a period of time, say 100 years, I think not stupid.
So Rags lost all credibility when he says he agrees with everything Jason said. I am going to firmly establish and solidify my credibility by saying I agree with Rags. And you know, for me, Rags' point that he made about the easing into it, that's exactly what I think needs to happen and will happen. When you think about the insect protein powders that we're using now, like you can get a cricket granola bar, like that's slowly becoming mainstream. Literally,
well, you can.
I will not live in a pod, and I will not drink the cockroach milk.
But that's the thing. Once you get over thinking about what's in it and you recognize it for the utility of what it is,
not happening. Like,
That's the direction we're going. Yeah, it's happening.
I will eat the people first.
Right, Rags, right. When you come to the
I'll
States,
eat the
Rags,
turnip first. Yeah,
yeah. When you come to the States, Rags, we'll take you to a game at Safeco Field, and literally you can get it sells out like by the third inning of fried crickets at Safeco Field. Like people are becoming like you and I. We can go to a restaurant down in Old Town right now and get crickets on toast with guacamole. Right.
I'll have to take you up on that. I'll come across one time and I'll take. I'm not eating them. I just want to see you eat them.
But I'm saying we're making this progression already on insect-based proteins, and I think we're just going to continue that progression because the ants aren't going to tolerate us like powdering up all these insects for much longer, and we're going to have to switch to ourselves.
That's right. We're going to have to increase chocolate production because chocolate-covered ants are delicious.
All right. Well,
I'm going to pretend you didn't say that.
Rags, you know, we give every guest the final word. We try to maintain a sense of decorum and politeness here on the show. So first, thanks again for joining us for the second time. And if there's any, we call them crab factuals usually. If there's any parting wisdom that you'd like to, you know, lay on Jason and I or our legion of fans, this is your moment.
Did you know that penguins have knees? I didn't know that until a couple of days ago, but penguins have knees, and that's messed with my head. Like, I always imagined penguins are wobbling along side to side because I thought, okay, like, you know the age-old question, would you rather not have elbows or not have knees? And I used to think, okay, if you don't have knees, you're going to walk like a penguin. But penguins have knees, and so now my life's a lie.
That is my favorite crab factual so far.
Yeah, that's the best crab factual. Somehow that will become a future episode. All right. Well, usually I have a witty quip for the outro, but for the outro on this one, I'll just say he is, it's Rag Reynolds on YouTube. How do people find you, Rags?
Rarerag.com.
Rarerag.com. So that's where you got to go before the Jason's custom outro track for this episode is over. I expect all of you to have gone there and spent some money on something. So until next time.